Not quite 20 years ago, Kenai Peninsula College anthropology professor Dr. Alan Boris discovered some fish bones buried in a pit below an ancient home site along the Kenai River. He dated them to about 100 AD, which places them during the time of the Riverine people, who inhabited the peninsula from about 1000 BCE to about 1000 AD. The discovery sat in the Kenai River campus archives for about 15 years before Dr. Boris found out that their DNA could be extracted relatively easily. That's where Dr. Ripan Mali, a paleogenomics scientist from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, comes in. What Dr. Mali discovered, how it was discovered, and what it means for Dr. Boris's work is the topic of this hour of KDLL's special Local Science Friday. Before we started, you had mentioned how you had been excavating near the college and discovered some pits. Why don't you kick off from right there again?
Sure. So this was 2001, and as part of a field school with students from the college, we were excavating a site from a culture. We refer to it as the Riverine culture that is known to have existed from 1000 BC to 1000 AD. The first that we know of salmon culture on the Kenai River. That is, before 1000 BC, there's no evidence of people using salmon, but there were salmon here, so either we're not finding it or something's wrong. It's not that they couldn't figure it out, I'm sure. At any rate, this is the first salmon culture, intensive use of salmon on the Kenai, on the Kasilof, on the Susitna, on the major river systems in Cook Inlet. So we were excavating a house, basically bisecting a house from one side to the other. A lot of artifacts, particularly a lot of what are called net weights. They were drift net fishing in the Kenai River. And stone lamps and other sorts of artifacts like that. In the house, in what would have been under the floorboards of the house, we found two pits. One was empty, and the other was full of salmon bones. And that was really quite a remarkable find. It was a clay-lined pit. The salmon bones had no head bones, no tail bones, so they had been gutted and cleaned, stored in the pit for, assume, future use, but for some reason they didn't come back, and that's one of the mysteries of this particular site. The bones were collected and stored in the anthropology lab at the college and just stored there for a long time. I knew that DNA testing was possible, but this was 17, 16 years ago. It was expensive, it was harder to do, and so I always had it in the back of my mind that we could do this. So what triggered this was two things. One was working with Dr. Mali on other DNA projects, and the second was the arrival at our college of Dr. Katie Buckley. And she had done DNA work for Fish and Wildlife Service, I believe it was, in Juneau, extracting DNA and doing whatever Fish and Wildlife does with modern salmon. And so talking with her, so we could extract salmon from these bones, right? So, yeah, sure. So we set about to identify, I think, seven vertebrae and package them up and sent them to Dr. Mali at his lab in Illinois and awaited the results. So,
And so you're talking about when you talk about they were a salmon culture and they use salmon. You're talking about catching them. I remember seeing some of those net weights down at the cultural center.
Yeah,
has some there. Was this? Could you tell if they were like smoked salmon, or were they fermenting them? Or?
I think they were fermented salmon, head cheese, commonly in rural areas called stinkfish. But I don't know. I mean, there's no way. Well, actually, there might be a way to tell. I don't know. With modern DNA studies, there might be some bacterial DNA they can pull off of them. Who knows? But they were. So what's significant about this group is, as far as I know, they did not have a way to store salmon for winter, other than to dry it or to make this fermented cheese. And a lot of people will turn their nose up at that, but I would remind listeners that we eat and drink a lot of fermented material today, but we elevate it to a higher cuisine. I've eaten stinkfish, and it's an acquired taste, certainly, but that's what it is. It's an acquired taste. That the trick with salmon is to figure out how to catch it in the summer and preserve it for the winter. And that they did not have apparently a good handle on, at least that we can determine archaeologically. The Denaina, the subsequent group that appear at 1000 AD, at least the salmon fishing Denaina, did have a way to store fish. So they invented a kind of underground cooler freezer that consisted of sewn birch bark moss and salmon layered in, that was then frozen and would stay frozen for throughout the winter, probably well into the next spring. That meant that they targeted silver salmon, the later run salmon, because they want to minimize the time between when you catch the fish and when you put it in the freezer, so to speak. One of our questions was, what kind of fish was this earlier group targeting? And I'd always thought they must have been sockeye or red salmon because of where the fish runs. So the logical place to net is at the bottom, just offshore. And that's where the red salmon run or the sockeye salmon run. So one of the questions we had, what kind of salmon were these bones that were filling this pit? And there were at least, I think it's at least 12 individual salmon in this pit. And that's the question that DNA studies could answer. And that's why we sent them off to Dr. Molly to find out.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to wrap my mind around the riverine people here. Did they get subsumed or extinct or move on?
Good question. First of all, I think they were most likely Yupik speakers. They were of a Yupik heritage, because that type of fishing was done on the Kuskokwim River and probably on the Yukon River. I don't know, but at least on the lower Kuskokwim. In fact, to this day, there are people who drift net in the river itself. Of course, using modern materials. So what happened? I don't know. I don't think it was a violent encounter. Could have been intermarriage. We don't know. But I think it was the main factor was the Denaina, and probably happened in the Lake Clark area, inventing this better system. So it was economic competition, essentially. They had a way to store salmon that the riverine people did not, and displaced them by just outcompeted them, so to speak, not for the salmon itself, but for the ability to store salmon to make this keystone species last throughout the year. And that was the key.
Wow. Let me turn to Dr. Molly. And once you got these, what was the first contact you had with Dr. Boris and these fish bones? How were you contacted? It's like, here's some salmon. Would you take a look at them for us? Or?
Well, I've been coming up here for the past 3 or 4 years because Dr. Boris and I have been working on a few different projects. And I think it was 2 years ago when I visited that he brought up the possibility of extracting DNA from these samples and seeing what we could find out about species ID, so identifying what kind of salmon they were. And then we also discussed the possibility of evolution of salmon, because right now there is data for 11,000 year old, or salmon that existed 11,000 years ago at Upward Sun River at a site in central Alaska. And at the time that I talked with Alan, they had just published a paper on salmon from that region. And so we thought about looking at salmon at that time period, 2,000 years ago here, and then modern day salmon, just to look at the evolution of salmon over time.
Oh, now 10,000 years ago, that wasn't long after the glaciers retreated, right? Up from the last ice age?
Right, so last glacial maximum was around 17 to 20,000 years ago, so glacial melts probably started around 16,000 years ago.
Wow, and so... And of course, the current thinking is, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Boris, people came from Asia across the Siberian land bridge to Alaska, one way or another.
One way or another. Still, evidence points to Siberia, but the route or routes are still being worked out. It, undoubtedly, there were multiple migrations, and there may not have been a migration as in one continuous movement. It may have been sort of stuttered, stopped for a while, moving on, and it could have been a coastal route. Almost certainly was, at least part of it involved a coastal migration. So the more we know, the more complicated it gets, but it's still pointing to Siberia from an origin standpoint.
And the people who settled here, I'm gonna guess that they were later migrants, perhaps?
Not necessarily.
No?
And it's also possible, I mean, and we're talking hypothetically here, that there was a coastal migration, and as glaciers retreated, then a back migration to the north. So it's not an easy picture. I believe it's going to show that Dena'ina, as an Athabascan people, are very old in Alaska. But Dr. Molly's been working on projects that show it's just not that simple. That, in fact, that very Sun River site shows. Well, I'll let him talk about it, but it shows connections that are. Not clear, let's say, or new information.
Well, let's talk about the salmon that you were sent from here in Kenai. What did you do to them, and maybe talk a little bit about the process too?
Right. So at the University of Illinois, my lab specializes in ancient DNA analysis or paleogenomics analysis, and so we have two different labs. One is an ancient DNA laboratory that is very specialized. So it's a room that is positively pressured and HEPA filtered. So only clean air comes in that's filtered, and it just, when you open a door, it flows out of the room and never into the room. And so we have an ancient DNA room, and then we have an ante room. So when you go into the ante room, researchers in my lab suit up into what we call a bunny suit. They put on footies, face masks, and clean all materials with something that will get rid of contaminating DNA. Because because that's the big worry with analyzing degraded DNA is contamination. Similar to in a forensic science DNA laboratory, you have to worry about contamination from modern sources because the DNA that we are analyzing is in very low concentration and degraded. And so once we are able to remove any contaminant DNA that may exist, we start the analysis, and that involves a DNA extraction from the bones by decalcifying the bone first, and then you break up the cells and you separate out the DNA from other parts of the cells, like the proteins. And then once you have purified DNA, the way it works now is there's been kind of a revolution in ancient DNA analysis with advances in technology over the past decade, where you can now create what's called a genomic library. And that is just creating a library of all the DNA within that sample. That's going to include, for the salmon DNA, bacterial DNA, all kinds of other DNA that may exist that has accumulated over the past 2,000 years. And then we end up sequencing all of this DNA. And so only a certain percentage of it is going to be the salmon DNA. And we end up with hundreds of millions of reads of DNA sequence that we then have to sort through computationally in order to identify the salmon DNA and separate that out from all the bacterial DNA. And so we're able to do that bioinformatically it's called mapping the salmon DNA to a reference genome of salmon. Yeah. And so we focused on the mitochondrial genome of salmon, and this is a special type of DNA that just traces your maternal line, so it will trace the mother's line, and that piece of DNA shows a lot of variation, and it's also the same type of DNA that was analyzed in the older salmon DNA from 11,000 years in age. And so we thought we could do this comparative analysis. And so we can also identify species from this segment of DNA. So it kind of serves multiple purposes.
Wow. Just for our listeners and actually a little bit for myself, I hear the word sequencing DNA a lot. What does that actually mean? What are you doing when you do that?
Right. So DNA is composed of four different units or nucleotides called, for short, they're called A, G, T, and C. Stands for adenine, guanine, thymine, and cytosine. And so just the makeup of these segments of DNA can control for proteins in your body and ultimately the physical traits of an organism. But you also have lots of DNA that is more regulatory, that controls the expression of these genes and the proteins that are made, or they used to be called junk DNA. They're clearly not junk. They have some kind of function, probably. We just don't know exactly what that is yet. But we can use that segment of DNA to help trace history, population history, evolutionary history, and genetic relatedness among different organisms over time.
Wow. And you mentioned mitochondrial DNA, and I see that all the time in regards to people tracking ancestry of human beings. Mm-hmm. So it's the same with fish, then?
Yes, it's the same with fish.
Mm-hmm. Man. So what did you find when you ground up and extracted the DNA from these 2,000-year-old salmon? And then compared them with your modern and more ancient samples.
Right, so we were able to compare them first for species ID, and we initially analyzed seven samples from individuals as a kind of a preliminary analysis. We're going to ultimately analyze more like 20. And we were able to find that 6 of the ancient samples were sockeye salmon. And 1 was coho salmon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, Dr. Boris, what does that mean to you, finding
that means,
this out?
In a small way, I was right all these years that they were catching primarily red salmon or sockeye salmon. And that's always good to know. If it had turned out that it was all coho salmon or silver salmon, then I would have had to backtrack a little bit. But I'm not that's science, right? This is, you know, we make hypotheses and we try to demonstrate through evidence. So that's confirming. But the other thing was within within the sockeye salmon, there were 2 groups. Hmm. So there's 2 runs of sockeye salmon, the early and the late run. Dick Rieger, who's a geologist living in this area, has written about those 2 runs and has hypothesized that the early run initiated in Prince William Sound. So Exit Glacier, which many people have been to, at one point flowed out and actually crossed the Resurrection River Valley, blocking flow, creating a huge lake. And the lake rose. Of course, it still spilled out both into Prince William Sound and eventually spilled out into the Russian River drainage. So the sockeye, if according to this scenario, came up into that lake and some spilled over into the Russian River drainage and to get out to sea went down the Kenai River and back again, and that being the origin of that early run of sockeye. The later run are different and presumably genetically different. So at least initially it's possible that those 2 runs of salmon are 2,000 years old, because the site where these salmon bones are from that show 2 populations is 2,000 years old. So it's been around for a while. And that's confirming as well.
It's amazing to think that that's why there are 2, there's an early and late run sockeye on the Kenai River.
Yeah.
It's something that I just thought it was a bureaucratic convenience for Fish and Game to just call these ones the early run and those ones the late run.
Well, I wouldn't rule that out either.
Oh.
But it's a science and everything happens for a reason. And we try to figure out what those reasons are. So this is a midstream study. You know, we're still working on it. As Dr. Molly said, we'll look at more bones. The initial results suggest that it's worth doing that. So it's a big choice. We're sacrificing something that's very precious, 2,000-year-old salmon bones, and you just don't find those everywhere. So another part of the study is then to compare Kenai River, modern Kenai River salmon to these ancient salmon. So this summer, Dr. Buckley has been collecting early run salmon, just the fins, it's all you need, late run salmon, red salmon, and then we'll be collecting some silver salmon.
That's a tough job, but somebody's got to go out the river with a fishing pole and do it, right?
Well, I should really be truthful about this, shouldn't I?
Okay.
So what she actually did is she went to the Russian River. She and her husband, Arjun Raman, went to the Russian River. That's the early run. And they just watched guys catching salmon. And Katie said, "Can I have one of those fins?" Which, of course, so we know where it came from. And it was done the easy way. Not that she probably didn't fish for salmon as well, but that's how she got those salmon. And that they'll be then analyzed. And then there's lots of other questions that can be asked that are more than just species, such as have these salmon on the Kenai River adapted over time, say, to temperature, water temperature. That seems to be one of the limiting factors with salmon is temperature. Right now, with the heat in Washington and Oregon, although those runs are decimated, but now the salmon are being just hammered hard because of the hot temperatures. So clearly there's an upper range and there's probably a lower range, and it could be, and I believe that would take nuclear salmon, a nuclear DNA, is that correct?
Likely,
so, yes. And that's a much bigger job, much more lengthy, much more time-consuming, but there's much more that can be done, and hopefully we'll get a clearer picture of salmon and people, human use of salmon over time.
Now, when you mentioned nuclear DNA, that's as opposed to mitochondrial DNA, right?
Right.
Could you explain the difference?
So, at least in humans, it's going to work the same way in salmon, more or less. You have nuclear DNA, where 99.9% or more of that DNA is stored within the nucleus of a cell. And then you have hundreds to thousands of mitochondria in a cell. And each one of those mitochondria also has their own mitochondrial DNA. And so the nuclear genome is, in humans, 3.2 units or billion base pairs long, whereas the mitochondrial genome is much smaller. It's only about 16,500 base pairs long, and so it's much easier to analyze the mitochondrial genome than it is the nuclear genome. The other important difference is the nuclear genome. We all inherit our nuclear genome from our mother and our father. We get one chromosome from each. Whereas for the mitochondrial genome, that all comes from our mother. Doesn't matter if you're male or female, that's going to come from our mother, and only females can pass it on to the next generation.
Oh, okay.
Including fish.
Including insects. Yep. The same in fish.
Right. Is there anything that you've come up with or discovered about these results that would indicate that the salmon from 2,000 years ago are in any way different or special? Were they exceptionally large or extra fat on them?
Right. So that's where we're kind of in the middle of this type of analysis. And really, now that we've confirmed that we can get extract ancient DNA and obtain complete mitochondrial genomes as well as a significant portion of the nuclear genome, we're probably going to increase the amount of data in order to increase the power of the analysis. And then we can do something comparative to the modern salmon DNA that Dr. Buckley collected, and then also do a comparison to other data in the general public database for other salmon out in the world. I know there's some data for salmon in eastern Siberia, the Kamchatka Peninsula, so we can compare to those as well as other salmon that are out there.
Mm-hmm. DNA testing has gotten much more convenient now. Is that the right word? Much more easier to do more?
Right. Yeah. So now really 10 years ago when we were still doing what was called Sanger sequencing, which was kind of the older technology, it was still fairly expensive and it was slow relative to now, where you can quickly generate hundreds of millions of DNA sequences, and it's become much more of a computational issue. So students in my lab, the first thing they do, they used to come in and learn the lab work and all those techniques but that's no longer the bottleneck. Now it's much easier to generate the data, but once you have the data, you have to sort through millions or even billions of DNA sequences in order to address your questions. And so learning the computation and the programming is what's really important.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty impressive. I've seen the screen, Dr. Rahman's screen, where he's got these base pairs, and it's screen after screen after screen of X's and O's and whatever else it is. And, you know, it's just, there's a lot of data. There's a lot of information. So it's not something you do, you know, send it off a couple of days and you're all done. It's very complicated.
You know, I'm sure there's probably whole semesters dedicated to explaining the question I'm about to ask you, but maybe you can give it a shot, in a radio interview format. When you've got the DNA soup, you know, the stuff you're ready to analyze, mm-hmm. and you analyze it, how do you know what goes together? Are they still stuck together in that state? The GA T
and C's, yeah.
C's?
So the way it works with degraded DNA is it's exactly that. It's degraded. So usually with fresh DNA that you get from fresh tissue, that comes in DNA strands that are thousands to ten thousands of base pairs long. Whereas degraded DNA, usually what we find is it's usually degraded down to 200 base pairs or smaller, down to, you know, even 50 base pairs. So it's really tiny chunks. And what you need is around 15 to 20 base pairs in order for a DNA strand to be species-specific as well as specific to a area of the genome. And so if you have at least lengths of DNA that are 20 base pairs or a little bit longer, you can map it to a reference genome. And so there's enough information there to identify species, so you can know whether it's bacteria or salmon or maybe even human contamination. And so you can map it to the correct species and the area of the genome that it belongs to, like what chromosome, or whether it belongs to the mitochondrial genome. And then you can also map it to various genes that you may have interest in studying. Also, because it's degraded, you have to be concerned with DNA damage. So as soon as the DNA leaves the body, the sources that protect your DNA from invasion by bacteria are no longer there. So bacteria start to degrade the DNA right away. And so you have to be able to detect that damage and do an analysis that prevents bias because of the DNA damage, because you don't want to your results to be influenced by artifact. So that's an important step. But it also helps you confirm that you are actually looking at ancient DNA and not contamination. So it's kind of works for you in one way, but against you in another way.
Oh, wow. Okay. I get it. Is there a point that you're going to that you can get to where you'll be able to have such a complete knowledge of the fish's genome that you could generate a picture of it, an image, we could know what it looks like?
Right. So there are certain genes that have been mapped to certain phenotypes that are somewhat predictive. So these would be traits that are very little influenced by the environment. There is the possibility of doing that. Most of my work is with humans, so I know those traits better than in the salmon. We would have to probably bring on a salmon geneticist at some point in order to help us with that area of the project.
I don't know. It sounds like you're the foremost expert that I've ever met. There are salmon geneticists, is what you're saying, though.
There are, yeah. So, because the salmon genome is somewhat different from the human genome. There was a major genome duplication event at some point in the past for salmon and other fish species, and so that complicates things a little bit when you're trying to map DNA sequences to a reference genome. And so we would need someone who knows a lot more about the salmon genome than I do in order to do that.
Now, what is a genome, what did you call it, duplication?
Duplication. So that just means a segment of the genome duplicates. Because there are segments of your DNA genome that are always copying and inserting themselves back into the genome. And so you have parts of your genome that are very much like other parts of your genome that have just evolved over evolutionary time for different reasons.
Well, so, but it would look like something else or someplace else in the genome, is what you're saying.
Right, yeah. So you could have a DNA segment that when you're trying to map it to the genome, it's, I mean, based on the algorithm, it says, well, it can go here or here equally within the genome, and you don't know where. So sometimes you can have situations where you can't uniquely map it to a specific region of the genome. And I think that will be more likely in a salmon genome, which has experienced a duplication event in the past, than more so than in the human genome.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Earlier, when I asked Dr. Boris about if the fish may have been smoked or if they were being fermented, and he said there might be a way of telling this. Is that anything you've run across?
Well, I mean, right now, I think a lot of work is being focused on the microbiomes or bacterial species that are within humans. So I have a student right now in my lab analyzing DNA from dental calculus of humans, and that's calculus is the you know, when you go to the dentist and they scrape off the tartar. So once that hardens, it becomes dental calculus, and that dental calculus will capture bacterial DNA that's in the mouth of a person, as well as food particles. And so she's working on an ancient archaeological site in British Columbia where she's trying to infer the oral microbiome of ancient individuals, as well as food that they ate, and compare that to the living descendants to just learn about the differences.
Let me ask you what else you're hoping to find out about these fish and what it means about the people who stored them.
Well, alluded to earlier, from the fish standpoint, if salmon have been returning to the same river system generation after generation after generation for who knows how long, they should be adapted to that river system in some way, either adapted from a natural selection standpoint or just from a gene flow standpoint. So in other words, Kenai River fish are special. And we hope to be able to contribute to that identification, as our Kosilof River fish, as our Susitna River fish, as our Nushigak fish, and so on. So that has implications in terms of development, mitigation. If a developing entity is going to impact the salmon, and we hope that doesn't happen ever, but if they're going to replace salmon, it's got to be Kenai River fish. It's got to be Nushigak River fish. It can't be just any old salmon they throw back in there. And then the nature of that. So at some point, there will be people that will look at salmon and humans in a coevolutionary standpoint. So people have been eating salmon for a long time. There's some evidence among Yupik people that there is a an adaptation to eating salmon in DNA methylation, that they are uptaking omega-3 fatty acids in ways that others aren't, and it's been inherited. We're going to look at that in some modern populations as well. So salmon and humans in Alaska have co-evolved, and we hope to shed some light on that. It's the, as far as the Dena'ina and Yupik people and others, it's the last place where people are still relying on salmon as a keystone species in the manner of their ancestors. In other words, from prehistory to now, Yupik, Aleutic, Dena'ina, Otna people and others have maintained that relationship both nutritionally, biologically, but also spiritually with salmon and salmon with them. So it's the last place, you know. The wild salmon are gone in most places. They're gone among the Ainu. They're gone on Sakhalin Island as far as wild salmon. They're gone in Scandinavia for the most part. One river left where they can actually get wild salmon. East Coast, you know, the salmon are gone. Their Atlantic salmon are you know, available as farmed fish and now GMO fish. But wild salmon, Alaska is that last place, and parts of British Columbia, that last place. And we also want to contribute to that story that this is an important relationship for all of us. And we don't want to be the ones who end that long story of salmon and human interaction.
I don't know if you know this. I'm from Dillingham.
I do know that.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, some of the things you're saying here, you know, have implications or could be applied to, you know, the Pebble Mine. I think you may have alluded to that briefly or...
Yeah, well, true. I worked for the Environmental Protection Agency describing the importance of salmon to the villages on the Nooshigak and Quijack drainages. So that, as part of that, we interviewed 53 people in, I think, 7 villages, asking how salmon are important in their lives. And It wasn't a story where you certainly or I were learning anything different, but we were really telling the story for the sake of the regulatory agencies and corporate entities that would possibly be developing that mine. How are salmon important? In other words, if salmon were impacted, if the rivers were impacted, and if therefore salmon were impacted, how would the people be impacted? So, for example, one of the questions we asked is, how do you define wealth in this community? No one said, nice car. No one said, nice house. No one said, a big bank account. What people said was one of several things: fish in the freezer, family, and freedom. And sometimes all three. That is, wild salmon, two freezers full of wild salmon. You've probably seen it in the rural villages, or in Dillingham for that matter. And it's got to be wild salmon. Family connections, the institution of fish camp, one of the few places where multi-generations of a family work together for a particular purpose. And we don't have that much anymore. But in that, the traditions are passed on, the values are passed on, the day-to-day activities are you know, defining who they are and as people, and really spiritual aspects. So still on the Nushigak and Kwijak, the villages that are Orthodox, and they're all Orthodox, perform once a year the Great Blessing of the Water. So it's an Orthodox ceremony, but I believe it goes way back, in which, in this case, the priest and the congregation will go out onto the river where an Orthodox cross is carved, and the priest will conduct a baptism, the same baptism he will do for a child. And then the water is perceived to be pure, removing human contamination, symbolically, if you will, but maybe, you know, if you're Orthodox, maybe literally. I'm not going to judge that. But at least symbolically, removing contamination to make the water pure for the return of the salmon. Pure water, salmon. People raised to the sacred, what is most important in their lives. Fastest growing segment of Christianity today is prosperity theology, which recognizes materialism as a way God rewards people. Well, I can go on about that. But here, salmon and clean water are raised to the sacred. They're one of the most important things, if not the most important thing, in people's lives. And freedom means the freedom to live their cultural traditions as they have for generations. The nature of the technology might change, but the attitudes, the importance, they don't change.
So, wow. Dr. Molly, you're a hard scientist. You work with numbers and science. Mm-hmm. I imagine a successful operation for you is when you get good clean results and you can interpret them. I imagine, but how do you feel when you hear the results? And what it could mean to, an entire region of Alaska and the people, the way Dr. Boris was just describing it.
Right. Well, I'm actually more of a social science / life scientist. And so, especially when working with humans, I think it's really important to consider the implications of your research, even before you undertake the research, going through and seeing how things might play out, who might be affected, and what might result from that research, I think is very important to do. And so I think I like to work in a community-based way where I partner with the communities that I'm working with, whether it's on human DNA or as salmon DNA or whatever species it may be. So yeah, I do like working with folks like Dr. Boris, who has this view and has thought about the implications of this research on a very wider level.
Are there more salmon bones out there to be found, or do you have your minions out looking for them,
Dr.
Boris?
There's always more. Yeah. Always more salmon to be found. Probably, I'm sure. I mean, the amount of archaeological work as far as from those sites has really been quite minimal. There's plenty more to do. It's important that those sites be protected so that work can be done. But there's more. The questions never end, and science doesn't get done in the sense of, okay, we've written the last book now, this is the last chapter, we don't have to do it again. New techniques, new ways of looking at things, new ways of understanding, that's what science does. And there's always more to do.
The development here in, all along the river, I mean, most of the development here is, you know, within just a few miles of the Kenai River and such. Are we losing a significant amount of ancient evidence?
Yeah, we are. Part of that is the way site protection is done in Alaska. Sites generally are protected on federal land and on state land, but not on private land. So it's the goodwill of the landowner in this case, who may know, or you know, in some cases won't know, but who may know that there's something there to be protected, and before any kind of change, that something be done to collect that information. But it's, you know, there's only a few people that do this work, and there's a lot that happens. But it's so important for the story of how we view the land and the landscape. You know, we're such a forward-looking culture, but really that arrow of time is important for us to create the values that are necessary in order to understand this place as a sustainable place. And we're beginning to look at that. You know, this radio station has programs now on growing, you know, growing food and all of that sort of thing. And we're beginning to look at sustainable agriculture, not on a large scale, but on a local scale. And we were, I think, shocked when the king salmon populations started to drop. No one thought that would ever happen 40 years ago. No one thought that would happen 30 years ago. But now the king salmon populations are impacted, and they're impacted in many parts of the state, much worse on the Yukon and areas such as that. And now we're beginning to take very seriously the importance of wild foods, particularly wild salmon. And, you know, it comes with that perspective of time. How has this been important to people over the ages? And will it be sustained in the future?
Now we have shows about gardening.
Yes.
And also, we dedicate a show to fermenting grains as well.
Yeah, well, it's the beer show. Yeah, I've heard that one too.
Well, is there anything else that I should have asked either of you about this topic or your work on it? I don't want to leave you wishing I'd asked you something.
I think it's important to think about who's conducting the science and what their life experience is about and their history. And science, for the most part, has been conducted by people of European descent. And so I think it's important to try and broaden that out to have, especially with topics like salmon, having indigenous community members learn and do the science, and especially the genomic science. And so I and others are actually involved in a program called the Summer Internship for Indigenous Peoples in Genomics, which trains indigenous community members and students in genomic science in order to be able to do science in a way that is consistent with their values and beliefs and history. And so I think it's important to try and broaden science to include these other views and ways of doing science.
You know, that's very interesting. I just as an aside, I always thought of something like genetics as being a hard science with microscopes and sciencey things. I'm not a scientist, clearly, but to hear you talk about how it relates to real people is eye-opening.
Right, yeah. What questions you ask and how you interpret the data that comes out of your research is all based on your values and history and experience.
Sure, what assumptions you go in with, right?
Exactly.
You were saying earlier, Dr. Boris, you had an assumption, you found the fish bones,
yep.
And so on.
Exactly.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Well, first of all, I would just second what Dr. Molly said about how important it is to broaden the perspective of who's participating, and in particularly among Indigenous peoples. We have a small but growing generation of anthropologists, Indigenous anthropologists in this state, who are going to have a significant impact, and are having a significant impact, on how we tell the story. The other thing I'd just mention is that salmon pit could never have been predicted. I mean, so when you find something, you got to be ready to deal with it, and in some cases that means dropping one project to take on another. Now, I know this one was 17 years before we really got to it, but you know, that's the nice thing about time. You got you got a slow development. So, you have to be ready to collaborate. And this has involved a lot of people, and it probably will involve a lot more people. And that's there's no one scientist anymore who can just do this and be the famous person that everybody holds up as the savior of the discipline. So collaboration is a key, and it's been fun.
You had mentioned earlier that there was there will be more to come. You guys have said that you're sort of in the middle of this. What's the timeline on the rest of the story, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I would also say we don't have a hard, fast timeline. We'll let the project evolve as important questions are answered, and then that will generate more questions. And it's a process, and that's really what science is. It's a long process evolving itself to generate information and perspective and knowledge.
Well, thank you both very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Alan Boris and Dr. Ripon Molly about paleogenomics and 2,000-year-old salmon on this special edition of Local Science Friday here on listener-supported public radio, KDLL. I'm Jay Barrett.